It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And a note about our programming here, the House Judiciary Committee will continue considering two articles of impeachment against President Trump. You can hear live coverage starting at 8. That's live coverage of the House Judiciary Committee sessions starting in about 25 minutes from now on WPR and online at WPR.org. Right now, we're looking at what the Washington Post calls the Afghanistan Papers. Earlier this week, the Post published thousands of pages about the long-running military campaign in Afghanistan. It's gone on 18 years. And so the documents together show a systemic failure in the U.S. effort to rebuild Afghanistan after claiming victory over the Taliban and al-Qaeda in early 2002. So how do you feel about these newly published documents on the war? What do you think of U.S. foreign policy in this part of the world? Should U.S. troops be in Afghanistan today? Join in any point, 800-642-1234. Nita Crawford is a political science professor and department chair at Boston University. She studies the costs and consequences of war. As co-director of the Costs of War Project, it is based at Brown University and Boston University, and it's made up of about 50 scholars. Nita, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
So this is thousands of pages on a single war this week. Perhaps for many Americans, information overload a bit. What should we be thinking today about war at this moment in time?
I think that what the Post's research has shown is that decision makers in the White House, the Pentagon, the State Department knew that they were running into difficulty in Afghanistan and the war was not winnable quite early on. And their optimism or hope or fear of electoral consequences kept them from telling the American people what they were seeing on the ground, which was they couldn't win the war militarily.
The papers also point to something like positivity bias, whereas these conversations going on inside the circles of government are different than the outward-facing conversation to the American public at large that this war is on track as we know it. What can you say there in terms of political science and what you see?
Well, if you're thinking about political psychology, there are a number of cognitive biases that came into effect. They ignored disconfirming information for the most part until it became unignorable. There's also a confirmation bias. Anytime there was anything positive, the decision maker sort of latched on to that and trumpeted that, even when they had other evidence that said that they're losing territory, for example, or that the number of al-Qaeda and Taliban were growing rather than diminishing. So it's actually a train of cognitive and affective effects that began right on 9/11 and have continued to the present, actually.
President Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, was director of intelligence for the International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan from 2009 to 2010. And so he said in this one document, there is a machinery that is behind what we do and it keeps us participating in the conflict because it generates wealth. What is the economy of war?
I think of it as actually a political economy. On the one hand, there are companies that benefit from selling weapons. There are companies, private contractors that benefit from taking over the functions of the U.S. military and performing them overseas, you know, providing security and training and so on. But the real problem is the political economy, that is the way that members of Congress believe two things. One is that they must support the troops unequivocally and in a full-throated manner and can't question conflicts, can't question war, must salute. And the other part is they're worried that if they say that we shouldn't have high military spending, that defense contractors in their districts will not have jobs, that people will reject reductions in military spending because they're concerned about jobs. Now, a couple of those things are wrong. For one, military spending doesn't produce as many jobs in many cases as other sectors, for instance, infrastructure or education or healthcare. But the other thing is, protecting the troops means not sending them out into harm's way if it's not necessary or useful or is in fact counterproductive.
What by the numbers and the cost of war project has looked deeply into the numbers. Where do we stand in the number of troops who have died in Afghanistan over these 18 years?
Well, the U.S. military has lost about 2,300 soldiers, sailors. And then there's other DOD civilians, a few of those people. Now, think about this. The number of contractors, U.S. contractors who've died, is greater than the number of U.S. troops who've been killed. In addition, about 43,000 Afghan civilians have lost their lives directly due to violence, bombs and bullets and fires that are caused by war. About 42,000, about approximately the same number of opposition that fighters have been killed, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, Haqqani Network, and so on. And hundreds of humanitarian workers have lost their lives. The war has also spilled into Pakistan, where about 24,000 civilians have lost their lives on the border and in related conflicts as the United States chased the Taliban and Al-Qaeda into Afghanistan. We also began to support the Pakistan. We also began to support the Pakistani government, sending them weapons, equipment, and providing training so that they could attack those militants. And when we did so, the Pakistani military managed to kill, in some cases, some years, more civilians than they did militants.
We're talking with Nita Crawford. She's a political science professor at Boston University, studying the costs and consequences of war as co-director of the Costs of War Project. You can join in. What do you think of U.S. foreign policy in this part of the world? Should U.S. troops be in Afghanistan today? Do you remember when we first went to war with Afghanistan? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nita, for people who haven't seen these documents yet, these thousands of pages yet, what are some of the interviews that stick out to you? And where did these documents come from? What did the Washington Post unearth here?
Well, they're mostly based on the work of the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. They had a series of papers called Lessons Learned. And they also did this in Iraq, where what they were trying to do was understand what the effectiveness of U.S. Action was and allied action, as well as the training of Afghan military and police, and then looking at the effectiveness and the costs and the benefits of aid to Afghanistan and Afghanistan reconstruction. So the focus there was on learning lessons. And those interviews were actually quite recent. In the last few years, they did not interview people from the beginning of the conflict, which of course is October 2001. And what stands out to me is at least at this point, post-2011, the officials like Douglas Lute and Michael Flynn are clear that the war is not going well. And yet, a couple of things are happening in public at the same time. There's a reluctance to talk about the number of Afghan military and police who are there, yet we want to keep funding them, that we've hoped have been recruited and trained. And there's eventually an erasure or a denial or a classification of the ways that those people are dying. In fact, more Afghan military and police have been dying in recent years than militants. They've been killed by the militants. So there's been disappearing data. The reporting on civilian casualties. Now, at various points in the war, the United States has emphasized that they wanted to be precise and protect civilians. And the focus on protecting civilians has waxed and waned. And what we see now is an increasing toll on civilians as the war has heated up in the last few years. But there's during this period that they're talking about, they're always saying that they regret the tragic loss of life and these are unintended consequences. Yet they're not really grappling with the fact that when they killed civilians, the number of militants was actually boosted and militant attacks actually grew because people don't like it when their brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers are killed in airstrikes and so on. So there's this in the documents, but also if you compare the documents to what's actually happening in the world at the same time as the reflections were being made to the Seeghar, you see that there's a dissonance, sort of a lack of grappling with the counterproductive nature of the use of military force in this place.
We're talking about the Afghanistan papers and the Washington Post investigation published this week with Nita Crawford. She's a political science professor, department chair at Boston University. She co-directs the Costs of War Project. How do you feel about the longest war? Do you trust the government when it comes to foreign policy in Afghanistan and U.S. troops' mission there? Should the U.S. stay in Afghanistan or pull out of the country? Join in with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back with political scientist Nita Crawford in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Washington Post calls it a secret history of the U.S. war in Afghanistan. It's 2,000 pages of interviews with senior U.S. officials, others directly involved in the conflict. The documents contain candid revelations about how U.S. politicians, how generals misled on the status of the war that's gone on 18 years. How do you feel about how the U.S. has approached its mission in Afghanistan? President Trump paid an unexpected visit last month, said he's reopened talks with the Taliban. How do you feel about U.S. foreign policy in light of the new documents and in light of our actions today? Join in 800-642-1234. Boston University political scientist Nita Crawford is co-director of the Costs of War Project, and she stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Emil is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Emil.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Two questions for your guest. The first question sort of arises, I was just in Paris recently, and I overheard a gentleman talking, and you know, he said, you know, for a country, referring to America, that seems to do a whole lot of global policy as a hegemon, its people tend to not know a whole lot about the world and international affairs. So as it relates to my question, your guest, how much do you think our perceived lack, or maybe the reality of our lack of international affairs literacy, how much does that affect, you know, what politicians think they can get away with? And as it relates to the second question, my second question, how much of the war right now is more about the war itself and more of a civilization, a clash of civilizations? Thank you.
Emil, thank you for that two-part question. Nita, the first part being that Americans really don't understand the nuances of foreign policy in other countries, specifically here in the area of Afghanistan.
Well, there's a lot to understand. I don't blame Americans for not being able to keep track of what's going on. But I think the key thing here is historical perspective. When the United States went to war in Afghanistan in 2001 and then in 2003 in Iraq, we were told that those conflicts would be quick, that they were more effective than the alternatives like sanctions or law enforcement. We were assured that these wars would be cheap, or in the case of Iraq, pay for itself, you know, that they'd be controllable, you know, and precise, few civilians would die, there'd be, you know, little permanent consequences for the budget and so on. In all of those cases and all of those promises, it's not been the case, right? And what we see is something that's quite familiar. We went to war in 1812 and in the Civil War and in the Philippines and World War One and Korea and Vietnam with the same kinds of promises that war be quick, effective, cheap, controllable, precise, and not have larger economic consequences. So if we're given better history, I think that we could see with some sort of more critical perspective, the promises that are made at the beginning of the war, and we wouldn't be so surprised when things go south. And then in terms of Congress and the members' responsibility there, the members in 2001, save one person, voted yes for the authorization for the use of military force. And the person with courage, Barbara Lee from California. Mm-hmm. said no. And I think that that's telling. She, at that moment of fear and anger, said, war's not the answer. She stood by herself. The American people in the 2008, 2009 began to be less supportive of these wars, but Congress has not had the courage to say, we must do something different. So I think we have to push Congress. Congress, as Ed Markey, the senator here from Massachusetts, says, is a stimulus response institution. They would respond to the American people saying, enough, or let's at least be careful and have hearings on a regular basis about the progress here.
Your research has determined that war spending in Afghanistan has totaled nearly $2 trillion since 2001. Do you find...
Let me just correct you on
sure.
that. Okay, so the spending for war comes in different categories. For uh-huh. instance, there's Department of Defense direct war spending. That's overseas contingency operations spending or emergency funding. That's about $1 trillion, a little under $1 trillion. And then there's State Department spending on Afghanistan. And that's total around $1 trillion. There's very little State Department money, actually, comparatively. It's about $100 billion. So,
how easy is it to trace the dollars when, as you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. data goes missing?
Well, there's a couple of things that have been going on with the data on military spending. It's always reported in current dollars. Mm-hmm. And there's a request by the Department of Defense. Oftentimes, the request for emergency or overseas contingency operation spending is added to by Congress, who wants to look strong on defense. And sometimes the reporting and the categorization is fuzzy. For instance, in the last 2 years, the Trump administration has added a category saying that the overseas contingency operation money should go to the base budget. So they've added a new way of accounting. So it's sometimes difficult. But essentially, what I'm using is the request by the Department of Defense and congressional appropriations to get the money spent on the war in Afghanistan in current dollars. And the same with the State Department. But the problem here is that because we've been at war so long, it's not just the spending for the emergency appropriations. The base military budget, that is the bulk of military spending that's supposedly non-war, has been inflated due to the fact that military pay has had to go up to keep people going back 2, 3, 4 times and reenlisting. They get reenlistment bonuses mm-hmm. as well.
Multiple tours. Uh-huh.
Yes. And then there's the fact that their healthcare expenses have grown because these conflicts are very difficult physically, especially when you're returning as many times as these soldiers have. And it's costing a lot of money to keep them healthy. That's their TRICARE medical expenses. And then in addition, there's replacement and upgrading of equipment. So the base military budget has increased. So that's part of the cost that we're tracking with the cost of war. Then there's Homeland Security spending and the spending on veterans. So there have been about 4 million people from the United States who've served in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the other places that were fighting in the war on terror, the 80 or so other countries that were engaged in. And those 4 million veterans will need health care now and over the next 30 years until they age out into other forms of assistance for medical care. So let's, we're including the cost of that.
Pause right here and bring in David in Milwaukee with thoughts. David, hi.
Hey, guys. Enjoying the conversation. Yeah, I was a Iraqi veteran, 2004-2005 OIF-2 Bravo Marine. My comment is I like your approach. I like the just the historical approach. My opinion, I'm a bit of a Pat Buchanan type of guy, which I guess makes me a bit of a Trump guy. I think we went wrong in the you mentioned it, the war in the Philippines, and I think our willingness to get involved in anything and everything over the last 100+ years has just been, it's brought a lot of benefits. I'm not discounting that. But violence begets violence, and I'm not a pacifist by any stretch.
David, I'm so sorry. We are short on time. Anita, I want to let you have a few seconds here. As David mentioned there, violence begets violence.
It also begets despair. And one of the most important things that we don't hear about, and it's not even in the Afghanistan papers, is the fact that active duty soldiers who we were just talking about and veterans are killing themselves at high rates. More veterans and more active duty soldiers died in the United States of suicide or abroad of suicide than have died in these wars in the last few years.
Nita Crawford, thank you so much. Nita Crawford is a professor, chair of Department of Political Science at Boston University, co-director of the Costs of War study based at Brown University and Boston University. I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.